Bismillah. Some years ago, I was at a conference, and at this conference, I met a young man who was a minister. He was quite young. He was maybe in his early 20s, or maybe he was a little older than that, but he told me a story. He grew up in a fundamentalist family. His father was a minister, and he became a minister by the time he was 21 years old. And he had been leading a congregation or working with a congregation for a few years, and he wound up somehow at one of these men's workshops that were popular some years ago. And the leader of the men's workshop said to him, and by the way, we have a lot of men tonight. Where are all the women? I guess it's... We're all beyond that anyway. Just souls here. And the workshop leader said to the group, "Now, find a safe place inside yourself and go there." And he didn't know what this meant. In all of his years of religion, no one had ever suggested to him that there was something inside. Now, lest you think I'm talking about one religion versus another, I'm not, because I know we could find the same thing in the Islamic world, especially in a place like Saudi Arabia, where they insist on the sort of externalized concept of religion. So anyway, this was the beginning of something for him. It was an opening, because eventually he got it. He was with a group of men, and spending some time with them, he actually found out that there was an inside. His state is not so different from, I would say, the common average state of many people in our culture, for whom inside may mean nothing more than visiting your thoughts, or perhaps looking at your emotions. In our understanding and on the path of Sufism, this work is about a balance between the outer and the inner. But in order for there to be a balance, there has to be an inner. And an inner not just of thoughts and emotions that are reactions to what's outer, but an inner that is relatively free, relatively empty, relatively spacious. And this is just for starters. This is just the beginning, really, of a journey, of a lifelong experience of coming to know what's of real value, coming to know what could be called the truth, the truth beyond theology, beyond human concepts, a truth that's known and verified through our own experience. And finding the relationship between something which we'll call the inner life and finding its real relationship to our outer life, and how the inner life can complement the outer life, how it can enhance it, how it can give it meaning, how it can, in fact, bring qualities into the outer life that are not there when we're just living as people totally invested out there, or in our thoughts about things out there. So, recently, too, I've been looking at some of the terminology in our tradition that describes the levels of experience of this inner world. It's actually quite precise, or at least there's some clearly differentiated levels of experience that are, for instance, in the Quran and picked up by the Sufis. So let's talk a little bit about that in the really basic terms. The first term that we refer to is called, it would be translated as the breast or the chest. And the word in Arabic is sadr. Often it's translated just as heart. And all the words I'm going to talk about tonight could all be translated as heart. In the sense that a heart represents a whole something. If we say the eye, for instance, you immediately have a picture of an eye and what it is. But you analyze the eye and you see that it has different parts. You know, we call it one thing, but it has different aspects to it, you know, physically speaking. Well, the heart, you could say, is something like that. So this first level of the heart, sadr in Arabic, or chest or breast, refers to a level of experience that is close to our emotional life. Emotional life, you could say, our inner whisperings, our expansion and contraction emotionally. And we as human beings, as conscious human beings, can begin to examine this part of ourselves, this aspect of our own life, and come to know it a little better. In other words, the self can enter the breast and experience what's going on there. And this actually is an experience that has also great dimensions and can lead to some extraordinary experiences of joy, of sorrow, of happiness, of disturbance. And this is a whole sort of realm of ourselves. But it is still, in a way, one of the most superficial levels of our inner life. I won't go into all of the references in the Quran tonight, but I may touch on a few of them. You may remember, it says in Surah Inshirah, have we not expanded, God says, have we not expanded your chest, your breast, and removed from you the burdens which had weighed down your back? So what's being described there is the fact that the divine can come into the human inner and expand it, purify it. There's a deeper level beyond the sadr, beyond the so-called breast or chest, and that's called the qalb, or heart, the heart properly speaking. What's extraordinary about the heart, you could say, is that the heart is not under the command of the self. The chest sometimes can be under the command of the self or ego, but the heart, well, it can be corrupted by the self, it can be polluted, we can do things that will have an effect on the heart in terms of taking away from its health and its vibrancy and its awakeness. But essentially, the significant thing about this thing we call the heart, which is quite an amazing fact, is you could think of it like this. It's really under the command of the divine. It's really under God. It's in you. You can ignore it. You can cover it over. You can obscure it. But it is essentially, one writer said, it's like the embassy of God within your being. How beautiful a thing the heart is, if we were to truly understand it, that it's with all of us. But I'm coming back to the idea I began at first. If our life is externalized, if our preoccupations are primarily, preponderantly about material satisfactions and ambitions, egoistic satisfactions, pursuit of immediate gratification, etc., etc., if that's what we're about, and even if I might say, with pity for most of us, the preoccupation with just getting by in this world, which is difficult these days, dealing with our responsibilities, holding a job, showing up for the job, finishing the job, things that we have to do, and no spiritual teacher, no prophet or saint would ever tell us that we shouldn't take our responsibilities seriously. But if these are our predominant and almost exclusive concern, there's danger. All kinds of dangers, actually. Not least the danger of superficiality and triviality. So coming back to the idea of an inner life, to know the heart, to sense the state of our heart, to sense the guidance of the heart, requires an ability to clear some space within ourselves. It requires an ability to focus our attention within our own being, not to the exclusion of outer life, not in such a way that we're just kind of like blanked out and totally turned within, although that's very good sometimes. In fact, it'd be good to have some time each day like that. But have a simultaneous awareness of outer and inner. To even be in relationship to the outer, but to be empty. And to have an empty space within ourselves. In other words, to be awake. To be really awake. Be in presence, to be in a kind of openness, maybe that's a good word, openness, an inner openness that allows us to live our lives, to be really paying attention, and at the same time to have an openness in this inner direction, to in a sense be able to catch those subtle impulses that come to us, the subtle intelligence that operates within us, which actually is an intelligence, you could say, in religious terms, it's divine guidance. It's the promptings of your divine friend, we like to say. So this is the kalb, the heart. It's two so far of four possibilities. You want to hear more? You want to go a little further? Or is that enough? No? Enough? More?
More.
Okay. The next level, it's the withinness of the heart. And it is, you could call it, we could translate it as the inner heart. The word here in Arabic and in the Quran is fuad. And the slight difference here is that this is going a bit deeper. If the heart itself is a knowing, fuad is seeing. Fuad
For what is this deeper knowing of the heart and inner heart in which you know, some of you may remember that this word ihsan, which how shall we translate ihsan, a really important word in our vocabulary, it means kind of perfect benevolence or goodness. And it was defined by the Prophet Muhammad as worshipping God as if you saw him. Now, worship just doesn't mean worship in the sense of being involved in a ritual, you know, not being in the mosque, not just doing the ritual prayer, but worshipping, reverencing, serving God in every moment of your life as if you saw the divine right in front of you. And since, to be realistic, very few people are like that, the next best thing is to know that you are seen. Now, this knowing that you are seen, for Sufis, has a beautiful meaning. It's not at all the kind of moralistic, sort of creepy feeling that God is watching you, to catch you making mistakes and to punish you, which is what the religion of fear might teach. But knowing that you are seen is a reversal of space. It's a subtle shift of perception. Whereas normally we are locked into our own viewpoint, I'm always seeing through my eyes, I'm looking at the world through my vision, my perspective. Imagine that you could just kind of let go of that and allow yourself to be seen. Feel as if space is looking at you. It sounds crazy. It's not crazy. It's just a subtle shift of being. We call it a dimension of self-observation, but that's a little misleading. It's not a self-consciousness that we're talking about. It's just suddenly allowing yourself to be seen because you realize you are within the presence of an infinite intelligence that is also nurturing, full of blessing, full of generosity, full of guidance. You're cared for. You're held in the vision of the divine. That's the second best stage. First best stage is to live and worship and serve as if you saw God in front of you all the time. This is what Muhammad passed on to us as the beautiful state of ihsan, a word, I-H-S-A-N, which is related to hasan, which means the good and the beautiful. But this is the most good, the most beautiful, is ihsan. The most beautiful state for a human being is to live that way. Every breath, as if you see the divine, you see the face of God everywhere. And okay, if you can't do that, at least know, be in that state where you feel that sort of fastidiousness that comes when you you intend to live beautifully. You intend not to wound others' hearts. You intend to do things in the most beautiful way. For this deeper state of the heart, the inner heart, that state that truly sees, is necessary. Fourth, in Arabic, lud, or al-bab. Al-bab means lud, and the plural is al-bab. Lud means the kernel of something, you know, the kernel of a nut, the essence, the nutritious essence of the nut is the lud. And so the lud of the soul, the lud of the human being, is a very, very deep, essential knowing. even deeper than Fuad, which we, the inner heart we just described. It's if the Fuad is the pupil of the eye, Lub is the light that allows the eye to see. What does that mean? There's something flowing into us from spirit, from the divine, into our inner life that allows us, brings with it insight in the sense of an insightful knowingness that is like, you could call it reason, but reason like on such a sublime level that you could know what action is most appropriate. You receive a kind of guidance and insight in each moment that just as sometimes we look at our actions and sometimes we're just bungling along and sometimes we know and see and act with a kind of reason, a very high level of reason, but not a mental analytical reason, a knowingness that supports our action, supports even our thoughts, a deep, deep, insightful knowingness from deep, something even deeper than the inner heart. So you have the chest, breast, sadar, and just slowly going back here. That in itself can be quite amazing. This beautiful surah in the Quran that says, and Camille often recites it, maybe when you recite it tonight again, we'll hear it. Have we not expanded your breast? It comes as almost a beautiful gift. The divine comes in and just opens you up. And a lot of people are like, a lot of people are walking around like this. You know. When we teach the turn, the whirling ceremony, sometimes I have to really tell people, come on, open up. Open your arms. Some people start turning like this. No. Open up, people. Let that chest expand. Even physically. We're talking about something more than physicality, but it has a physical component too. So the sadar, the chest, that which can, light can come into it, when the divine energy comes through the heart into the chest. Actually in the Quran it says, faith, the beautiful quality of faith can be inscribed there on your sadar, on your chest. God, as if God could come along and write, the divine could come along and write, inscribe faithfulness on your being. And suddenly your whole emotional life is different. Instead of being governed by resentment, envy, and pride, and fear, and so forth, there's a lightening, there's an opening. That's the most superficial level. Then the heart, next level, called the embassy of the divine within our being. The heart belongs to the divine source. And there's another saying some of you will know. The Prophet Muhammad said, there is something within the body, and when it is healthy and whole, then the whole body is healthy and whole. When the heart is sound, all of our other functions are sound. Our intelligence, our emotions, even our physical body. So much depends on the quality of our hearts. That's why Sufism is above all the science of the purification of the heart. Freeing it of all envy, all resentment, all false pride, or meaning arrogance. Pride is not, what we mean by pride is not being proud in a holy way, which is possible, but proud is thinking you're superior to others or looking down on others. Envy is not to envy somebody who has something beautiful and good, but to wish that they didn't have it, that you had it instead. You can, I mean, what a negative state it would be to envy the holy. You see somebody who's truly, you know, truly kind, truly good, truly generous, truly with God, and it just pisses you off. That's envy. Resentment, that low, simmering dissatisfaction and anger that you hardly recognize about your circumstances in life, about the people you share your life with, about the world you're in. Very unhealthy state. All of these things can just be blown away and your breast purified by the divine through the heart, which is with God. And the inner heart, that which even more than the heart itself not only knows but sees, and sees deeply. And the seeing is, I'm throwing in some categories here, some words for those of you, because I know some of you will appreciate this. We have in Arabic the word darajat. Will be raised through levels. Every human being on this spiritual journey will go through certain levels. And the other word for that is mertaba, ranks, levels from which we see. Every human being, we don't all look from the same level. And even we ourselves don't always look at life from the same level. We move through different levels. Sometimes our vision may be fairly high, sometimes it's really low. So we need to know this. This is also part of the inner life. We began talking about the inner life. Now we're seeing that the inner, how much depends on the inner life, because as our heart becomes purified, our vibration changes. As our vibration changes, our level of perception changes. And the way things appear changes. Someday you're looking at the world and everything looks kind of mean and ugly. That's you. It's not the world. If another day you walk out and you fall in love with everything you see, praise be to God. It's another level. I won't say it's you. I'll say it's seeing with his vision, with the divine eyes. So, the inner vision, the fu'ad, is the levels of seeing that we're capable of, that can be deeper and deeper, or higher and higher and higher, or inner, more and more inner. And finally, getting back to the final, the last, the fourth, al-lub, the kernel of insight, which can be so profound, so perfect, so beautiful, that it informs every action, every thought, every movement, every word. So, this is why we need an inner life. If we have only an outer life, one thing, the outer life will never satisfy us. It will never bring us happiness, except in the most, maybe if you're really, really lame and superficial, and it's your destiny to be almost like just a talking animal, maybe even a good person, but still just a talking animal. Maybe you'll be satisfied with that. And so be it. God bless such beings. But even those people can sometimes be subject to the unexpected to the evil around them or within themselves and have very little defense against it. To be totally absorbed and preoccupied with the outer life can never satisfy the heart, can never bring peace to the heart, and can never bring us to the true happiness that we as human beings are meant to experience. That's why spirituality is the most important subject in life. There's nothing more important. It may take us a long time to get that, right? If you're young and you have an inkling that it's so, God bless you. Our true happiness, our true state of well-being comes from our ability to be in contact with a state of well-being, of timelessness and perfection that's beyond all circumstance, does not depend on any conditions. And this we're meant to know. And this we can know through opening up the inner life and allowing the inner life to meet our outer life. By deepening through all of these levels. Because what we're really doing in that journey within, or that journey of the inner life, is a journey back to our source. It's a journey toward what we essentially are. And it's what we essentially are is calling us. Because it wants us to know its love, its generosity, its beauty. Rumi talks about it in a bunch of ways. I think I may have a selection here that with this little introduction, I'm going to read you some selections from Rumi that were made some weeks ago on the subject of spiritual perception. See if these maybe mean a little more. He says, since our vision is so limited, let's go. Let our sight be dissolved in the seeing of the friend. Our sight for his. What an exchange. Or, though the universes are 18,000 and more, not every eye can see them. Every atom is indeed a place of the vision of God. But as so long as it is unopened, who says there is a door? Every atom is indeed a place of the vision of God. And here's one that refers to the fact that in the Quran, there's a chapter called The Bees. And in it, part of the message is that the bees that make honey and hives are, in fact, their work of making honey in their hives is from divine inspiration. God, it says in the Quran, and God inspired or revealed to the bees. So, revelation for the bees was how to make honey. What then is revelation for human beings? What God taught to the bees doesn't belong to the lion or wild ass. The bees make a home of juicy sweetness. God opened the door of that knowing. And what God taught the silkworm, does any elephant have such expertise?
Adam, though made of earth, was given knowledge by God. A knowledge like light that pierced the seven heavens. So it's this knowledge, this inner knowing, that characterizes human being at its best, a knowledge like light that pierced the seven heavens.
So that's our little theme for tonight. Raise any questions in you, cause any confusion. Is there anything you'd like to share? Will it move you to do something new? To strengthen your practice? To deepen your practice? Appreciate the possibilities of your life.
There was one aspect where you had said not quite us, you know, speaking of God. I mean, I'd be interested in your sense of understanding of that separation.
Well, good. That's something really simple. I just meant to remind us that our knowing depends entirely on the higher influences that come into our own faculties. That's why I said it's not you as you now understand yourself, but that this beautiful knowing, this illumination, this light, this insight, this seeing and this knowing is inspired in us. It is from that source. Just prior to that, I'd been saying how our problems, our negativities and so forth are from ourselves. So I just wanted to remind us that of what is so often forgotten. I mean, maybe it's obvious to all of us here. I don't know. I hope it is. But the obliviousness in our culture seems to be so entrenched that the idea that we need something higher than ourselves hardly enters people's minds, even in the field of religion, it seems. People are so much absorbed in the self. These are just a few quotes from the Quran. And whoever it is God's will to guide, God expands his breast so that he follows a light from his Lord. And God has endeared faith to you and has beautified it in your hearts. God has endeared faith to you and has beautified it in your hearts. He's put the beautiful quality of faith. I mean, maybe, I don't mean automatically, all the time, for all of us. But sometimes, for some of us, God willing, faith, meaning our participation in the spiritual nature of reality, is given to us. Not only given to us, but it's beautified in our hearts. Heart is made beautiful. And when the heart is made beautiful, then the human being is beautiful. He gives wisdom to whom he will, and he to whom wisdom is given has truly received the highest good. But none can remember except the people of Lub, the people of that of insight. Many of these things would sound like religious cliches if the heart is not really sensitive and open to them, if there isn't some supporting knowledge to understand what's being said, to understand the reality of it and the importance of it, the necessity, the urgency of it.
We converse about this subject in the vernacular with the word intuition, and it's like a catch-all of knowing and insight, but there's no source attributed.
Right.
And
good point.
What we're talking about here is to take that a step further and acknowledge. What came to mind as I listened to you was that all that sensing and that knowing and that insight is a function of this as an organ of the heart. And somewhere in there for me, the angelic comes in. The room is full. And I sense that as like an intermediary source. Because there's still, I mean, I know there's not a separation from God, and yet when I hear that still small voice, I put another name. I mean, I know it's a minion of God, and maybe someday I'll just say, thank you, God, for that insight. But it is available to us every moment of every day. The man that you all met, he went to his church many years ago. Michael Ray taught it at Stanford to the MBA students, but he couldn't bring in religion. Mentioned Sufism quite a few times in the book. But it was, you know, he had his students convinced that it was available all the time. Mm. But it makes it easier for me to have a deep faith in the source. Whatever name we choose, God, Allah. So thank you. This is a wonderful, wonderful subject tonight.
And you know, the name is not of essential importance to us, but what distinguishes intuition from intuition, you know, intuition can be, let's add to an intuition a sense of awesome quality. You know, if I were, what's his name, Michael Ray, and teaching at Stanford, I would try to find the language with, if I knew that the audience was not going to be receptive to the kind of language we would use here, for instance, okay, you know, we understand that. You know, we're not, we can be flexible with language. But what's not to be missed is that we don't want to reduce intuition to something like, as I know some people have done, you teach it in business school, and it's for executives to make better business decisions that lead to slightly greater profits. You know, better margin, because your CEO has intuition. He knows, you know, how much natural gas to send down this pipeline. You know, or where to frack. Where the fracking is good, by intuition. talking about something so much more than that. We're talking about something on which our hearts depend. Our eternal life hangs on this. Our present life hangs on this. So much more than just a little guessing game where you're slightly ahead of the competition. Right? It's it is to have one's soul beautified and to have one's soul be in peaceful harmony and gratitude and to convey that and not just to have it for oneself but to be able to share it, to transmit it, to radiate it. Is it making sense, Chris? Natalie? Making sense to you?
Yeah, I think one of the advantages we have is that we speak a language that's much older than ourselves, in that there's so many figures of speech that use the word heart. You know, we speak of our heart. But the world insists upon using it in a very vague way. And so many recently that I've come to understand with any precision that it's a particular thing, it's actually something real and it's definable, experienceable. Yeah. There's a joke in my family when you don't know what to say about a problem, you just say, I think it's a heart problem. Because it's so vague that you can get away with anything. It feels, it sounds consoling and everything. But I think, when I was young, I often wondered why we were always talking about the heart. What is the heart? It's just an organ. Mm-hmm. But, then you realize that this is something fundamentally human, the search for. Yes. It's a mystery.
So it's interesting that you say it's fundamentally human because, and maybe our society as it exists right now isn't the standard of what is fundamentally human, but we've deviated from that. But it seems like our base state is to not know our calling, like the bees, like they know nothing else but to make honey. Like their revelation and their life are one. There is no, like, to not make honey would be to not be a bee, but we as humans, in the society, it's almost like our state of being is to remember our mission and our state of being and who we are in our essence, but in that it implies that our base state is to not, there's a disconnect between it. So I don't know if that's just because we've evolved to that point and we originally were united somehow, or if the remembrance is the part of it. I'm not sure.
Well, the teaching in Sufi tradition, Islamic tradition, is that all of nature is naturally in submission to the divine, except for the human being, for whom it's left to be a conscious choice. Our free will, which you could say is, a blessing and a curse, and you could say it's also part of our development from the rest of nature, leaves us with an option to be heedless, to turn away from reality, to be ungrateful, to be presumptuous, to spread corruption on the earth, or to remember and give thanks and praise our source, to sense our relationship to our source. So it's left to us, it's left to every human being, to the free will of human being. This is how it's explained. It's addressed very explicitly in Sufi tradition. The submission which the human being is left to choose is the natural state of the moon and the stars, the natural state of birds and the fishes and the trees and the mountains. That's our situation. But then the question is, what is the human honey-making capacity? What is it essentially? That question is never explicitly answered except in the most general terms, which is that we're here to serve the divine, to love and serve the divine.
Do you think it's really a choice for everyone? If someone doesn't know there is a choice to be made, then maybe that's fake nature versus nurture, and the environment creates the person. But if someone, if they didn't happen to meet the right person or come from a context in which they would even be presented that there is a choice to make, and they're only bombarded with this Western culture, share, pick whatever one you want, and that this is the entirety of their reality, there doesn't seem much choice in that.
I can't argue with you on that. It certainly may seem that way. The answer of the tradition is that human beings will not be held responsible for knowledge they don't have, will not be held against them. But then the other question is there something in us that really does know and chooses to forget or chooses to ignore it? I don't personally know that have a final answer to that, and it certainly is not a matter for us to judge others. But I think we're here, you know, if we take the world as it is, and we're here in a culture where there is so much heedlessness and so much ingratitude and so much, you know, just blind presumption, those who know the joy and the beauty of living otherwise will want to share it and will do their best to find a way to share it, not through preaching, but in some way. That's what motivates us in almost everything we do. Everybody in this room who's had a taste of that.
I have a question, a metaphysical question. What's the difference between your heart and your soul?
Well, that's a good and a difficult question, because they're very close, in fact. And whereas the heart is the intermediary between the self and the divine spirit within us, the heart is like the midpoint. When it's awake and functioning, it bridges the gap of separation, of apparent separation between the self or the ego and spirit. That's the function of the heart. The soul, it's not like there are two different things, heart and soul, or even four different things, heart, soul, spirit, and self. But we use these words to try and, it's a taxonomy, you know, it's a scheme, it's a representation. One definition of the soul is that it's the result of the meeting of self and spirit. Spirit being that sort of dimensionless point within the heart and soul, like if we went through these four levels, go another step beyond lup and you get to pure spirit, ru. Okay. So the meeting of that spirit and the self if there is a meaning, produces soul. Soul is like a substance. Soul is a substance to be nurtured, to be developed, to be purified. If there isn't that contact with spirit, if theoretically that contact is, let's say, 99% cut off, then you have a pretty soulless human being. A human being who lives by a kind of thin, you know, superficial reason and analytical functioning, or just desires and lusts and so forth. So there are different forms of soullessness. But to be soulful is to bring the spirit into one's very self, and it's the result of the meeting of these two things. And so it's a, you can see a slight difference. If the heart is the mediator between self and spirit, and the soul is the result of the meeting of the two, then the soul and heart are kind of like very in the same field. But it's just by talking about them in these different ways, we highlight different aspects of it. Now, what's relevant, we say, give yourself heart and soul to your work. May you have a beautiful work, spiritual work that you can give your heart and soul to. In contrast to that, you could say, what do you sell your soul for? And at what price? Is your soul for sale? Is your life for sale? You know, for some people, yeah. You just pay me. You just tell me what you want me to be. I'll be there for you if you pay me enough. That's soullessness, isn't it? It's a state of commercial humanity. The commodification of the soul and of human beings. And, you know, some months ago we focused on a saying of the prophet where he said, every day people go out into the world and trade their souls. What will you trade your soul for? Garden of eternity? Experienced here and now, or some cheap satisfaction, some accolade, some notoriety, some superficial prize. When the soul becomes really sensitive, when the soul has faith inscribed on its heart, then we live in such a way that it is our greatest pleasure to... And there are lots of ways I could say this, but one way that it's said is submit, surrender, prostrate, and draw near to God, which I don't necessarily need a physical posture to do. It's a state of being. It's a state of return. And the more we engage with life, which is what we're meant to do, we're not necessarily meant to withdraw. At least not for most of us, most of the time. There are some beings who have reached such a level of rarefaction and refinement that it is their job just to be in the unseen. We know some of these people. It is their job to be in the presence of God most of the time doing that work. Those are rare beings. They could be in this world. They're not running away from it. They could perform superbly in this world. That's not their work. For the rest of us, life is a school. It's a school of love, ultimately. So we are meant to be engaged with it. But engaged in such a way that when we see where it's taking a toll on us, it's exacting too high a price, then it's time to worship. Then it's time to meditate. Then it's time to do zikr.
to remember, then it's time to make that, take that step back into the inner life to regain our balance, to regain our strength, and then come back to life when we're ready, when we can, with that balance, a balance between the inner and outer. Till eventually there's no difference between sitting alone in meditation and going to the hardware store, or going to your job, or being with your family or partner. Ultimately, to make everything in life sacred and make everything in life a form of worship. Alhamdulillah.